Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Love music? Love interviews with lovely musicians? Search Virgin Radio UK on YouTube to find brilliant album specials with some of the shiniest lights on our playlist, including George Ezra.
This is going to be something I'll remember, and that's a really lovely thing. I don't think I was able to do that in the past.
And James Bay. Come on, let
it go. Don't you agree that everybody needs someone when they feel alone?
Watch all that and more at youtube.com/Virgin Radio UK.
All right, it's time for another round of Who's Got the Best Job, us or our guest? All right, bring it on, Vassos.
We've got someone in here to tell us if there's anybody out there. She's an award-winning astrophysicist, astrobiologist and actual planet hunter. Her new book, Alien Earths, Planet Hunting in the Cosmos, is out now. They say in space, no one can hear you scream, but on Virgin Radio, everybody can hear Professor Dr. Lisa
Good morning, Lisa!
Good morning, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the top of the tower.
It is gorgeous, and I do appreciate the normal British weather that you got me, sunshine and gorgeous London.
You're going to Berlin, aren't you, soon?
I do.
When's this?
That is on Thursday.
Okay, because it's really hot there at the moment. It's 28 degrees there.
Well, I'm going to send some sunshine over there, over here, a couple of degrees for
Apparently
you guys.
We're going to get it. They're going to give it to us. That's very nice of them. Thank you, Germany. So what's it like to have an asteroid named after you? Asteroid Kaltenegger 7734.
It actually started pretty funnily. So I'm sitting there. I'm working, and then one of my colleagues comes in and was like, "So Lisa, your birthday, 4th of March, 77, right?" I was like, "Yes." And he leaves. I'm like, "Oh, what happened now, right? It's all right, you know." And then he came up the next day and he's like, "You know what? We want to name an asteroid after you." And I'm like, "Whoa." And then I was like, okay. Well, one question. It's not going to hit the Earth, right? Because we all know dinosaurs, right?
Yeah.
And so they promised it wouldn't hit the Earth and then was super honored to be named after it. So there's no news going to come. Kaltenegger's coming. So we avoided
that. What do we know of your asteroid? Where is it? What's going on with your asteroid at the moment?
It's happily flying in space and it will keep flying in space long after we are all gone.
Thank you for dating life on Earth. How did you do that, Lisa?
Well, the cool thing about the Earth is that it's actually kind of an alien planet when you think about it, if you go back in time. And we have some rocks that are super old, and we can figure out how old they are because some radioactive elements actually get into their daughter elements. That's the scientific term. And so we can figure out how long that took. And so we have 4.6 billion years that the Earth was around, and life probably about 3.5 billion. But the easiest way to think about it is if you do a 24-hour clock for all the history of the Earth, because I have to imagine this somehow. It's just big numbers otherwise. And so 5 a.m. and the 24-hour clock is when we know there was life. But lunchtime, when there was oxygen, you couldn't breathe yet. And about a second before midnight, you and me.
That's very good. I love it. I know you do that in the book. I read that bit. So, Alien Earths, Planet Hunting in the Cosmos, Lisa Kaltenegger. So we are looking for life on other planets. We're hunting down other planets. That's what you and your team are doing. I say we, you're doing it on our behalf. And you suspect other life forms may be doing the same, coming our way. Is that about right?
Well, actually, first, I would want to say there is an open job offer if you want to help, you know, if you guys want to come and help me out.
Quite happy doing this at the moment, but never say never.
Never say never. Good things. And so when you do that, when you look for life in the universe, right, at one point, it strikes you as like, if there's life out there, where would we be the aliens?
Yeah.
And would somebody be really scared of us? What do you think?
Well, I think, I don't know. What do you think? It's more important what you think than what I think. You're the genius here.
The key point is, it's pretty funny when you just go out a little bit, and that's like 300 light years. So light takes up to 300 years to get through the stars.
Here we go. There
are 2,000 stars that have just the right vantage point, just the right point of view. They could see us as an alien planet and figure out that there's something breathing here. And in a way, you know, when you get out in the morning, you can see if you want to be the alien or if you want to be the nice, gentle alien today.
Oh, my gosh.
Think about it.
Yeah, no, I could have done nothing but since reading your book. Tell us about why planets wobble, the wobbly planets. The wobbly stars, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. Because the planets are so tiny that it's so, so hard to find them. And so basically what we need to do is we need to be smart about it by looking at the star, the big and bright thing.
Right.
And so when a planet goes around the star, it actually tucks on the star as well. It's like when you walk a dog. You don't really have to see the dog in the park to know that somebody is pulled in the direction they really don't want to go, right? And so for a star and a planet, it works pretty much the same. So we see the wobbling or the movement of the star, and that tells us something's tugging. And this is how we figure out there must be a yet unseen world. And the cool thing is that we have more than 5,600 worlds around other stars. Stars,
oh my God,
that we already found.
It's too much, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
brilliant, but it's too much for my brain.
Well, I do have to say, we need help. This is why I was offering you a job. I have like 5,000 planets and I need somebody to help me out.
You were serious.
Absolutely. You know, this is a good recruitment opportunity. You, me, Vasos.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
And we have some very clever listeners, thank goodness. And so when you talk about the stars wobbling, you do that thing in the book that scientists do a lot. And you say, we can't see the planet, but we know there is one there because of the wobbling. Stars are not only that, because of the degree to which they're wobbling, we can size the planet as well. This is amazing.
Well, the thing is, like, if you go to the park and there's like a tiny dog, the person doesn't have to lean back that much, but a huge dog, right? You will see the person leaning like crazy.
Yeah, you can't see the dog. You think that's a big dog.
And that's how we do that with stars and planets. We can weigh them.
Right. Well, I mean, you talk about light a lot. And you talk about, you know, light is so important. There's a lot of different light going on in your lab. Tell us about your lab. Tell us about your 3-year study that you did. What were the questions you asked when you embarked upon it? What were the discoveries during it? And what has been the outcome?
So the cool thing is that we have all these new worlds, and some of them are just at the right distance, the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, and small enough. So 1 out of 5 stars has a planet that could potentially be like ours. Potentially, we don't know yet, but for the first time ever, we have a telescope who can figure it out, the James Webb Space Telescope. Yeah. So you have 1 out of 5. And in our galaxy alone, we have 200 billion stars.
Yeah.
So we have billions of possibilities. And so what we need to figure out is, like, what would the light of a planet with life look like in my telescope versus one without? And that's what we're doing. And so think about it like a light fingerprint database. Like when you go to the crime scene and you have to cross compare the fingerprint, we do that with light.
That's what you talk about, isn't it? This fingerprint of light, this fingerprint of life that you and your laboratory and your team, that's what you're renowned for, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a big deal.
Well, I think it's a big deal because, you know, Sherlock Holmes, me, you know, trying to find out planets that there could be life. Absolutely, I'm going with that. And so the key thing is that these planets could be a little bit different than ours, right? There could be no green planets. Maybe there are purple planets.
Yeah.
Maybe they're kind of gothic kind of versions. I don't know.
Yeah.
But life is so diverse on the Earth that we want to figure out how different life, like life that's not green plants, would look like on another planet, just to not miss signs of life that they're there. And the best way to do this is actually to generate these models, kind of like a weather report, a little bit more complicated, for planets with other suns, a bit more chubby planets, a bit less chubby planets, different kind of biota on it. And so that's, in my mind, how I generate this data fingerprint of light.
It's so simple when you reduce it for our benefit like that, but it's still so complicated. And so it's complex and complicated, isn't it? And that's the thing, and sophisticated. You talk about Jupiter, you talk about Mars. Before we get onto those two planets, because they often grab a lot of the headlines. By the way, I didn't realize how big Jupiter was until Lisa told me exactly how big Jupiter was. But let's talk about the birth of our ozone layer, because that's been really important in our evolution. So when did that happen? How did that happen? And what have we benefited from as a result of it happening?
The fun part about it was basically a mistake.
Right.
It was a trial and error where life was like, oh, what can I do to gain energy? And so it basically started to use water and sunlight, and then there was some oxygen come out, like a waste product.
Right.
But it started to be everywhere, right, because nothing used it. A little bit, you know, it just rusted the planet a little bit, but other than that, it was there. And then some entrepreneurial life figured out that there's a lot of energy in oxygen.
Right.
But that made life more complex. But also, yes. when UV hits it, right, the thing that you need sunscreen for, when that part of the sunlight hits oxygen, it generates this ozone layer, and then the UV light is sheltered, it's shielded. So all of a sudden, actually, the continents became a safe place to be where you didn't get singed all the time.
Right.
And I think that was also one of the ideas that we have why life then made it out on the continents. And then in the end, colored our beautiful world yeah. green.
And so, the firewall for life before the ozone layer was the oceans.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
You want to be underwater or you want to be underground, and you're fine.
Right. And you talk about us getting as far down to the bottoms of the oceans as we can, and what life exists there, and it can't come up because it would explode, and we can't go down because it will get crushed. So just speak to that for a second, if you don't mind.
One of the things that's just really crazy is when you think about life, like the whole life on the Earth,
yes.
it is so completely different than what you and me usually think about, or what I thought about before, that this kind of work. Just diving deep in the oceans, if you're a diver, right, you know you have to be careful because the pressure becomes higher and yep. higher. And so the kind of life that's adapted to these dark, high-pressure places, completely different than ours, but still, you know, ours, I mean you and me, but it's still life on our planet. And so when you go out and you think about these worlds out there, and I love that I get to talk about sci-fi worlds, which ones could exist, but there are worlds out there, they are crazier than what even sci-fi could invent. And some of them are called water worlds, where when you would dive in that ocean, actually it would get so dense. The pressure would be so high that you would generate ice on the bottom of the ocean, but warm ice, because it's still warm there, so it doesn't float anywhere. And so the interesting thing is, if you and me would dive down there, all the water in our body would become ice too. Let's not do that.
Some people we suspect in this business are ice from the yeah. inside out anyway, but that could happen for real. Yeah. Why don't we send them down there
yeah.
and see if they survive? See,
this is why you want to work with me, because I have all the survival tips. So if we ever get to that planet, we know where to go in.
Offer of work is more and more genuine the more you talk about it. So let's go big, and then we're going to go really small. Let's go to Jupiter. You give Jupiter a few pages. Why not, of course, but why particularly?
Well, Jupiter is the biggest planet in our solar system. So if you could open up Jupiter, you can't. But if you could, you could throw all the other planets in, and there would be place to spare. That's how huge Jupiter is. And the fun part about thinking about this is that the rocky planets in our solar system are very small, because it was too hot where they formed, so there was no ice and gas. But then at a certain distance from the star, it got so cold that ice and gas stuck around. And so you could make much, much bigger balls. And one of them is Jupiter. And the crazy thing about how different these worlds are is that Jupiter has storms. So I think about a tornado. And there's one that's called the red spot on Jupiter. And you could throw our whole planet in the Earth, and then be room to spare. So actually, there's a storm on Jupiter that would fit the Earth and some.
Oh my gosh.
And so our solar system is crazy. And there are a couple of really interesting moons around Jupiter and the other big gas planets, like, you know, Saturn, the ones with the
yeah,
ring.
Yeah, Saturn.
And there... Saturn. In our solar system, we have hopes that there might be life. And so this is where we do, in our solar system, try to find it here. And then look at the stars and see the light fingerprint of these alien planets. Try to figure out if something's breathing there.
I was reading your book last night, and I just couldn't stop looking at the sky. Because I was reading it, you know, I started reading about 6 o'clock and the sun started to go down. It was a beautiful sunset last night.
Gorgeous.
And it just reminded me, I try and look up a lot, you know, because I leave the house really early in the morning. And if it's a clear sky, you know, I do try and look up, and there's not a lot of light pollution where I live. But I just, why don't we look up more? I mean, you look up more because you're aware of it. But I just think we all need to look up. I mean, we talk about being mindful and we meditate and we do all this other stuff, you know, remember to breathe and, you know, remember the breath and meditate on the breath. But we've got to meditate on the skies more. I think it's maybe because it just, it's so overwhelming that, you know, but if it's so overwhelming that if you surrender to it, it gives you this sense of freedom for the to live the rest of your life differently. Do you know what I mean by that?
Absolutely. I think like whenever there's like something, you know, that bugs you or some problems that pile up, right?
Yeah.
That are really not that big of a problem, you know, it shouldn't just bug you this much. I sometimes just go and look at the sky
yeah.
and I count to five stars, one out of five has a planet that might be like ours. And I'm like, you know what? I can let go of this grudge. I have a cosmic connection. We are all made out of star stuff, right? Because everything we made out of was generated either in the core of a star or when the star exploded. And now our curiosity made us figure out if there may be other worlds like ours out there. And at that point, I'm like, you know what? It's fine.
Yeah.
That stress that I had before, let it go for now because there's something bigger around me that I need to figure out.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Love the 80s? Then you'll love Virgin Radio 80s Plus.
Love Chris Evans. Love the 80s.
Over on Virgin Radio.
80s Plus.
What's going on with you and Carl Sagan? I mean, I know nothing can go on, you know, literally, but something's going on with you and Carl Sagan, isn't it? First of all, for people that don't know, give us a minute bluffer's guide on Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan was an amazing scientist in the US. Yeah. And for the first time, he connected people to the science because, you know, think about it. Science was seen as stuffy and people were thinking, oh, it's the ivory towers, the person in the white lab coat, and you cannot take part of it. And he broke that by making the Cosmos TV show that inspired so many people worldwide that just brought you in and said, hey, science is our birthright, our curiosity. You know, we did this. We figured all this out. And you and me are part of this adventure story. And so he was at Cornell and he started to bring different fields together, like, you know, the biologists trying to find life, the astronomers, because luckily we live in a time where no one can know all of the science anymore, right? Because there's too much to know, which is really, really good. And so he had an office. And then when I started there, they were like, so Elisa, would you like to have Carl Sagan's office? And I'm like, would I like to have Carl Sagan's office? I'm like, I might be able to be persuaded. Do have to say, not as great as a few as you guys have, but it is Carl
can
Sagan's
sense,
old office.
Can you sense Sagan when you go in there?
Well, you know, the thing is actually, it would have been the exact same view that he had. And so sometimes when things get just really busy, like everybody knows how happens, right? I'm like, no, I'm taking a minute, because he walked through the door, looked outside at the trees and thought about how can we spot life? And I'm going to do the same. I'm going to take this extra minute and just don't care about everything that's going on. And so that's how the connection through time works.
And so he brought together astrobiologists, astrophysicists, but you embody that yourself in both, don't you?
Absolutely.
You qualified in both.
I think the key point is that we need more and more and more and more brains and ideas to figure these really hard problems of the forefront of science out. And one of them is like, how can we find life?
Yeah.
And he did something visionary a long time ago. But science has grown. And so by taking his approach, we just basically connected even more people together. And I think the key is really good coffee. So the one thing I did
You're talking about coffee all the time.
I have one here.
I was worried for our coffee last night reading this book. You start off with a story about Portuguese coffee, don't you?
I do. And then actually it was pretty funny. Once I finished it, my editor was like, so coffee? I was like, yeah, but you know, scientists, you know how everybody's made like 70% out of water?
Yes.
Scientists tend to be made out of 70% coffee. Of coffee.
So do DJs. Can we talk about what the littlest heroes in the book? These little organisms, which have survived the last five extinction events. I mean, we've talked about cockroaches a lot because cockroaches survived the last extinction event. But these leave cockroaches literally for dead.
Yes.
What are they? Where do they come from? And how have we helped them? Probably against that. They haven't really volunteered for the job. They've been sort of stuck in the middle of. What's going on with these guys?
So you're talking about the ideal astronauts. And I have to qualify that because, you know, all the astronauts are going to get mad.
Yeah.
The ideal astronauts are ours in cosmonauts and everything.
Yeah.
But if you look at the crazy, interesting things that life has developed to survive in very harsh conditions, there is, I think, for me, one tiny astronauts that I love the most, and that's a tardigrade or water bear. That's what we call them. They are super cute and they are tiny. You need like a microscope to look at them. They live in a dewdrop or in moss. So you've stepped on them for sure.
Sorry.
But the really cool thing about them is like, if things get tough, and this is usually when water becomes rare, they just shrivel up. And in this tuned state, what they call, they can just live in suspended animation, basically, for more than 100 years. Then you drop a little bit of water back on them and they're like, hey, I'm fine. Walk around, lay some egg. It is great. I'm like, wouldn't that be cool as a survival skill, right? I don't want to shrivel up per se, but to honestly just say like, oh, you know what? I'm going to sleep for 100 years and see how humankind is doing. Having said that, I'm not sure if we're going in the right direction. However, wouldn't it be cool to see what kind of technology and things we'd have?
Okay, so then we sent them to crash test dummy school.
Oh my God, yes. The
funniest
part. What
did we do to these poor things?
So somebody actually put a couple of those in a lander. I don't know if you remember this idea of that Israeli lander that was supposed to go to the moon and it crash landed.
Yeah.
And so usually you don't bring any organic material with you, at least not without permission, even though the moon's not protected because we don't think there's life. So there's lots of rules where you can actually litter organic material in the solar system.
There's astro poop, isn't there?
Yes, there's astro poop on there because I was looking in this and I was like, it's not the first organic material. There's actually astro poop on there. And I was like, why would there be poop? But of course, that means more weight to bring stones back. And I'm like, I can see how the astronauts actually made that trade-off for NASA. But somebody just put them in that Mars, in this moon lander, and it crash landed. So we basically littered the surface off the moon with tardigrades. And then the question was like, well, are they still survive? And there was just a brilliant... So this is where science is really fun. You know, you think it might not be, but it really is. So, you know, consider the offer. That... Cool thing about this, then a team here actually in Britain then started to say, well, did they survive? And the way they did it, they basically used bullets that they emptied in the middle and put them in and basically fired them with higher and higher speed against a wall to see when the tardigrades would become mush. And I'm like, oh my God.
They made it to 2,000 miles an hour.
I know, crazy.
That's not just the speed, that's impact speed.
That's impact speed.
So unfair on the tardigrades.
Yes, absolutely. But the interesting thing is that we do not know how fast the crash landing was, so they might still be okay. And I put this in the book because I just thought it was funny to say, like, they are not waiting for a kiss to be awakened just for a drop of water.
All right. Can we just talk about our next door neighbor, the star next door and its planet? Because this is very important. So Proxima Centauri.
Mm-hmm. Proxima Centauri.
Tell us about our next door neighbor.
And so the cool thing is, if you think about the universe, it's huge. If you think about our galaxy, it's huge. And the way that I usually think about it to actually get to these terms is if you take the sun and the eight planets in our solar system and you put it down to the size of a cookie, shrink it in your mind's eye to the size of a cookie, then the next star over, our neighboring star, Proxima Centauri, is about four soccer fields away. Or football fields, or rugby fields, was just in New Zealand. People were like, what, soccer? I was like, how big is the rugby field, right? So I was helping out with the sport and a lot. And so that one is about 4 light years away. So even light needs 4 years us to them and the other way around. So what's kind of crazy, because you were saying we should discuss dark sky more. So when we look at Proxima Centauri tonight, we see it like it was 4 years ago. And it sees us, if anybody were looking, like we were 4 years ago. So, you know, think about if anybody wanted contact 4 years ago. Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah.
The further away you go, that question becomes bigger and bigger. But even that one, even that neighboring star actually has a planet just at the right distance that could potentially, might not be, but could potentially be another planet like ours. And wouldn't that always be in the top 10 travel destination just because it's close by?
Out of 10, right, what do you think the chances are of there being other life in the universe? Is it a full-on 10 for you? Does it have to be?
No, it is 5 plus minus 5. And I borrowed that answer, meaning just like it could be nothing or it could be everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this is why it's so exciting, because we're at the verge of figuring this out. Because if we knew, it'd be a little more boring, right? Kind of, you know, I do want to know, but it could be anything. But we know there's billions of possibilities, and we for the first time have the tool to figure it out, a telescope big enough to catch that light. And so I wrote this book because I think it's passing us by a little bit that we live in this incredible era of exploration,
yeah,
and what we need to know and what we're trying to figure out and what that tells us about our own planet too. That in a way is really a spacecraft that we are on our journey through the cosmos.
Miles an hour. I get up every morning. We're on the spacecraft. Here we go again. We're on this. Forget the bus. Forget the cab. Forget the tube. Forget the bike. Fine. You know, jump on any of those. Go for a run. But we wake up, woohoo, on a planet, our own spacecraft, 67,000 miles an hour. And, you know, yesterday, Elon Musk was just given approval in China for 100% self-driving cars. We've got a self-driving planet.
Yeah.
Sorry, Elon. Late to the party again.
If you go to Michael Singer's office,
yes,
in Florida, he's got this like this big hall,
uh-huh,
and on the side of the wall of the hall, big huge hall, it's just a black. It's painted black.
Yes,
and actually, it isn't painted black. He sort of stops his talks and says, "No, have a look at that wall, that massive wall that you think is just painted black. Actually, if you look right in the middle, right, there is a tiny dot, and that is a photograph of our Earth from 200 million miles away."
Right.
And that's us. We're all
we're rocking, man. We're rocking.
We're just on this planet spinning around in the middle of nowhere.
So time, is it an arrow?
Oh, yeah.
Time is an arrow.
And we can just go one direction, sorry.
Yeah. So time doesn't pass. We pass through time. So just chill your bones, everyone. Is that right?
I think that's a great idea. And when you were just talking about, you know, the Earth whizzing around the cosmos, I'm like, sometimes I do use that as an excuse not to go running.
But your husband runs, can you tell me before? I love the fact you're on a world tour with your book, because you'd have to be. You can't just tour like a city. You've got to tour the planet because you're the planet lady. Alien Earth, Planet Hunting in the Cosmos, Lisa Kaltenegger, Professor Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger. Anything else you'd like to say, because we've got to finish, but please have another minute, whatever you want to say.
Well, you know, it's one of these things where I'm saying, I hope you guys are taking up the offer, because we have 5,000 planets and I have only so much time, you know?
She heard something about our contract that we haven't heard, because she's offering us alternative employment. It's our 31st birthday today. For heaven's sake. Congratulations, well done. New Zealand, the UK. So this is a world tour for your book.
A little bit, but you know, I was just like, if there's any interesting places, happy to go anywhere else. But I love our planet, and with every place you go, you just see how astonishing this world around us really is. And I think sometimes that's really worth opening your eyes to the sky and to the world around us. And to the amazing people around us and the other creatures.
All right. Superb. That's great. Great. I knew it was going to be great to meet you. And it's been controlling round of applause, please, for an official planet hunter, Professor Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger.
Love music? Love interviews with lovely musicians? Search Virgin Radio UK on YouTube to find brilliant album specials with some of the shiniest lights on our playlist, including George Ezra.
It won't be like this forever, so just enjoy it while it's here. It's a really wonderful thing.
And James Bay.
It's about me. It's about my relationship with Lucy. It sums up so much of what went into writing this whole album. We're all works in progress. I still don't necessarily know who I am.
And Depeche Mode's Dave Gahan remembering the late, great Andy Fletcher.
I'll be honest with you, the first thought that came in my head was, I wish I'd been a bit kinder.
Watch all that and more at youtube.com/Virgin Radio UK.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.